Father in heaven, we thank you because you love us and you've shown yourself to us in so many different ways. We thank you also for your word that guides us and draws us close to you. We thank you for John and Dan and how they minister to us by sharing the things that they know about your word and help us to have a deeper faith in your word. And I pray that this morning as we listen and as John speaks to us, that our understanding of who you are and of your word will deepen, and that our hearts will be open to the message that you have for us this morning. Be with John as he speaks. We love you and pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Great. Thanks, Pedro. All right. So, like I already said, I do not have a watch. So, somebody will have to watch me when it gets to be.
When you want to take a break.
Yeah, that'll work. Great. Okay. Oh, it turned itself off. I know, but I'm not going to. Yeah. We'll figure it out. It's not going to be a big deal. Okay, great. Well, thanks for coming. Let me go back to the outline for the class. Okay. We talked about the New Testament documents. We talked about the manuscripts and the evidence they show that the New Testament, the Greek New Testament we have available to us, is very reliable. We talked about the forming of the New Testament canon. We concluded that somewhere about the end of the first century, something like a New Testament canon was forming. By about 150, it was somewhat fluid, but for all practical purposes, the New Testament canon had been arrived at. By about 200 BC, there's no evidence of any significant debate. Then we talked about the documents that support the Old Testament. And we admitted that what the Masoretes did in the 8th century, more or less, somewhat limited our access to older manuscripts, so therefore there was around 1,500 year gap between when the Old Testament was completed and when our manuscripts were. But thankful to God or to the Essenes or luck or whatever you want to say, with the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that gap was closed from about 1,400 years to around 250 years or 200 years. And the, what's important is, if we span that gap, that huge gap, the number of differences was quite small. And that's over three-fourths of the gap. So then to conclude from there that what we have is approximately as similar to the original as comparing the Dead Sea Scrolls to the Masoretic text is a reasonable conclusion. Okay, so let's get through all these slides here. Yeah, I think this graphic here showing the roughly 1,400-year gap between the finishing of the Old Testament and the oldest Masoretic text from the end of the 10th century, and then about three-quarters of that gap supplied. All right, so anyway, so in conclusion then, the canon of the Old Testament was set by general consensus of Jewish rabbis, perhaps as early as 300 B.C. or even 400 B.C., and certainly it has been unchanged since 200 B.C. when the Septuagint translation was made. The Hebrew and Aramaic text of the Old Testament we have is remarkably close to the original. Now, not, like I said, the New Testament manuscripts, the New Testament Greek we have, is virtually identical to the original. I'm not making that strong a statement with the Old Testament, but I'd say the kinds of differences are almost certainly small, insignificant with regard to our anything that we believe as Christians. All right, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to spend the next section talking about comparing what I believe are the inspired texts with what I believe are uninspired texts. And if you ever want to get a feeling for what we mean when we say that the older the New Testament is inspired by God, just take the time to read anything else that anybody else ever called Scripture. And I would say that would be a great evidence. It's like if you wanted to know, such and such long jumper, how good they are, Try jumping yourself, all right, and compare yourself. You go, oh, okay, I get it now. All right, that is pretty impressive. But then multiply that by 100. So we're going to look at the Old Testament Apocrypha. We're going to spend a fair amount of time there, to some extent because it's kind of a fun topic to talk about and learn about. But remember, don't forget the reason we're doing this is because we're doing it as a comparison so we can understand the context for inspiration. And then we'll very, very briefly mention some other Jewish extra-biblical writings that some people actually want to include in the Old Testament. Then we'll talk about church father writings. I already mentioned this in terms of forming the canon, but I'm going to talk about it in from the perspective of showing reliability and inspiration. And then we'll look at some of the heretical writings. Yeah.
In terms of reliability, are any parts of the Dead Sea manuscripts of the Old Testament considered superior? I know they're older than the Masoretic texts.
Well, considered superior. Okay, now, better, you have to decide what you mean by better.
Well, I mean,
for example, for us,
which is closer to the original.
For us, more information is better. Okay?
That's good information.
Because if we can assume that there were some changes over time, we're assuming that there were some changes over time, we believe most likely they're not significant, then the more information you have, the more you can maybe make some reasonable guesses or estimates about how much change has happened. Okay? And so what we have, like I said, we have Dead Sea Scrolls that seem to be more in line with the Septuagint translation, which was made around 250 B.C., and we have Dead Sea Scrolls that are somewhat more similar, according to scholars, to what the Masoretic text is. So what that shows is that there were different lines of texts, just like with the New Testament text, the Western and the Alexandrine, and it just takes both lines back into B.C. So the Masoretic, we can find the Dead Sea Scrolls that are more in line with the Masoretic text, and we can say, therefore, that shows us that the Masoretic text really excellently reflects what we had 1,000 years before that. But we also can see that the Septuagint does provide useful information to consider what was in the original Hebrew, because there's Hebrew manuscripts that seem to be more in line with the Septuagint. So it's more information. It may or may not settle all possible questions. For example, a reading in the Septuagint or the Masoretic, which is the original. Okay?
And all the Dead Sea is in Hebrew?
Every single text in the Dead Sea Scrolls, I believe, are in Hebrew. I don't think there are any Aramaic texts. There might be. If there are any Aramaic texts, I don't think there are. If there are, they would be of the Essene stuff, not the biblical stuff. Okay, and remember, even the biblical texts stretch for about 300 years. The oldest of the manuscripts has been dated to around 250 B.C., and the youngest was around 50 A.D. So there's a 300-year gap range even there. Okay? Good. So let's talk about the Apocrypha. And again, remember, the reason we're looking at this primarily is to make comparison. So the cool, interesting information about the Apocrypha is not the main point. It's the comparison, okay? The comparison of the Apocrypha to the New Testament really helps us to get a perspective. Okay, oops, let me see. Did I skip a slide? Yes. Just some of the information. What we now call the Old Testament Apocrypha, let me show you the list of books here. Tobit, Judith, Addition to Esther, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, Wisdom, Ecclesiasticus, Baruch, the additions to Daniel. All right. So those things which are included in, for example, all Catholic Bibles today, and were included in Luther's Bible, all right, got it? And the very early Protestant translations also included these. All right, these were included in Jerome's Vulgate, which is the Latin translation made in the 380 A.D., and we know for a fact, because he said so, that Jerome did it under great protest, because he knew that these documents had never been in Hebrew. although it's possible one of them was originally. There were no Hebrew manuscripts available. And he knew, number one. Number two, he knew that the Jews had rejected these. And it seemed, and my premise is that the canon of the New Testament was what God used the early church fathers in some sort of inspired way that I can't prove, but based on the evidence, to create the New Testament canon. Similarly, I believe God inspired the Old Testament, people who gathered the Old Testament canon. All right, got it? They reject these books, and they weren't even originally in Hebrew, so naturally Jerome didn't want to include them. He was a scholar of both Hebrew and, well, Greek. Well, yeah, that was his first language. They became incorporated into the Vulgate, and the Vulgate became the Bible of the Western world. Also, in the Greek church, in the Eastern church, they were using these books. In fact, the Jews did not. You know, the idea that these came into our Bibles because the Jews were using them is simply not true. In fact, there was a conference, if you will, of rabbis in the second century in which they said, look, these are not our Bible. And I get the impression that they did this at least in part as kind of a pushback against the fact that the church was using it. Okay, got it? Yeah. Well, see, what the thing is, you have to understand, they didn't have a bound manuscript. This is the Old Testament. What they had was scrolls that were used. All right, and so these are Greek writings, the Apocrypha, and they're around, and Jews read them. And for all we know, some Jews considered them inspired. But the evidence is that the Jewish leaders never did. So the bottom line is, if somebody had in a box all their scrolls, probably some of these would have been thrown into that box. So that's what I mean by the question mark. In other words, Jerome's contemporaries said, yes, this is part of the Septuagint. Jerome disagreed with that, but one of the reasons it's debatable is because they didn't have this. Okay? By the way, this is my Jerusalem Bible that, you know, I have this recurring dream that I'm reading a Bible and I find, oh, I opened right to wisdom. I opened right to, it just so happens. All right. I have this recurring dream that I'm reading the Bible and I find a book. Oh, wow, I haven't read that one yet. I know it's a weird dream, but all right. But if you get your Jerusalem Bible, it'll happen to you on a number of times. Okay, these were never quoted by Jesus. All right, there's a possible quote from 1st Esdras. From 1st Enoch in Jude chapter 14. But 1st Enoch is not even in the list that we call the Apocrypha. In any case, I'll talk about that as a bit. Now, here's the thing is, the church fathers, these are people like Origen and Clement of Alexandria, they started using these things a lot. By the 4th century, the Christian church was using things like 1st Maccabees, Wisdom, and all those, as if they were inspired. All right. So the reason that they're included by the Catholic Church is because, well, that's the same church that was around back then. They have a continuous line there, and so that tradition arose. And we're going to look at some of these things, and we're going to see maybe why they were tempted to pull these in. We're going to see some quotes that would be really nice if you want to support false doctrine that is included in Catholicism.
Yeah. So the people pressuring Jerome, that wasn't really a
No, but this was the Western Church trying to sponsor this translation, and the bishop in Rome was part of the attempt to have this translation made, because there were many other Latin translations of much poorer quality. All right, this is the late 4th century. By this time, Roman bishops were beginning to claim primacy. It was not accepted across the church at all, but the Roman church was beginning to claim primacy over the churches by that time. The first person you can reasonably call a pope, I say, is Leo in the 5th century,
right,
who really did govern the Western church with essentially supreme authority, at least in the Western church. Okay, anyway.
Question, you say alluded to in Hebrews, where's the allusion?
I think it's in Hebrews 13. There's the Hebrew writer, he's preaching a sermon, and he makes a comment that seems to reflect something that he'd read. Probably, I can't remember. I have to look it up. All right, but it's not being quoted, and it's not being used as authority. I mean, you know, we throw things in our sermons all the time. And Hebrews is a sermon. And so the significance of the fact that there's an allusion in Hebrews 13 to something from the Apocrypha doesn't really provide much evidence that it was considered inspired even by the Hebrew writer. It seems quite strongly true that neither Jesus nor the apostles considered the Apocrypha inspired. Luckily for us, because when you read them, you go, no wonder. You know, that's my point. That's my point. Okay? These were written in the 3rd and 2nd century B.C., even the 1st century B.C., perhaps. Never quoted in the New Testament except Jude 14. The difference between an allusion and a quote, I mean, it's not an exact quote, but it seems to be pretty much of a quote from 1st Enoch. First Enoch is included in the Ethiopian Bibles. It was never included in the Greek or Latin Bibles, but it is included in the Ethiopian Bibles. Okay, by the 3rd centuries, they were quoted extensively and treated as scripture by the church fathers, rejected by the Jews in the 3rd century, not in the Jewish Bible, included in the King James, the original King James. I believe even the King James, they removed it later, is included in Luther's Bible. It was excluded in the 17th century, not the 16th century, by Protestant churches. Okay, anyway, here's the list of books. I'm going to spend, you know, just a couple minutes on each one, just give you a feeling for the content. And you can read them. I make this bad. I should never, ever make this joke publicly. And you borrow it from your Catholic person because they're probably not using it. Ha, 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 ha. I should never make that joke publicly. Ha, 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 ha. Because it's me. I know. It's just mean. And it's really, you know, I take it back because there are many Roman Catholics who are very devoted to the Bible. Seriously. All right. So let's talk about Tobit, Judith, Additions to Esther, Susanna, Bell, and the Dragon. I'm lumping these together because what these are fables. Just read them. And they're obviously fables. And then you have to ask the question, is there anything in the Old Testament that's obviously a fable? And if you are having trouble answering that question, just read Tobit. Just read Judith. Just read Bell and the Dragon. And these are fables. Now, could a fable be inspired? Well, what about a parable? I mean, I suppose, except that these things have obvious historical errors. Unlike Ecclesiasticus and Wisdom, which have theological and doctrinal errors, I don't know about that. So things like this, Tobit uses smoke from the liver and heart of a fish to drive off a demon. That's kind of strange. In Judith, Nebuchadnezzar is called the king of the Assyrians. That's a pretty bad mistake. On the Additions to Esther, it's actually just a Jewish targum. The original writer obviously never intended to be included. Just read it. It's just a commentary, basically. Why somebody included a commentary, I don't know. And Susanna, it has Daniel as a young boy. And from that day onward, Daniel was greatly esteemed by the people. And it just feels like a fable. Bel and the Dragon. Daniel convinces Cyrus that Bel and the Dragon are mere idols, and it's a nice little morality tale. And you can read that. But it's kind of hard to take these things seriously, that's my point, as being in the same league with something that's inspired. So I... Yeah, they clearly are. None of them were ever in Hebrew. Or if they were, there's no evidence for that. So we can almost certainly assume they were never in Hebrew. Yeah?
In the Apocrypha, do they include any of the Gnostic Gospels?
No, see, that would be a new... You have terminology here. There's the Apocrypha, and then there's the Pseudepigrapha. And the Pseudepigrapha is a collection of Jewish writings that were never included in the canon except possibly 1st Enoch in the Ethiopian Bible. And so we're talking about Jewish stuff. You asked about something that could be, people might claim would be associated with Christianity, not with Judaism. And now, then the term New Testament Apocrypha, that's a very confusing term. Whereas with the Old Testament Apocrypha, there you go, okay? There you go. All right, the New Testament Apocrypha, it's hard to define that. But then there's another thing, which is Gnostic stuff. Okay, so there's really four groups of kinds of writings, all four of which were in my original outline here. Okay, and it's good to keep them separate. So far, we're only talking about the Old Testament Apocrypha, which the list of books is pretty, you know, we know exactly which books we're talking about. And then there are other extra-biblical writings that were given a certain amount of authority that were certainly believed in by the Jews. You can even see Jesus talking to Jews who believed in some of these things. He never quoted them or gave them any credence. All right, yeah.
And just on a personal note, when I was studying to become a Christian, I actually used this Bible.
Yeah.
And it didn't affect in any way what I had to do, what I had to believe,
what
I had to do to become a Christian. So
right.
Even if somebody has a Bible with the Apocrypha in it, it doesn't in any way change the doctrine of how to become a Christian.
Yeah, it doesn't. However, there are blatant false doctrines in Ecclesiasticus and Wisdom, blatant false doctrines that would be confusing from a Christian perspective. But remember, these are all interesting questions, but remember the reason we're looking at this is to show by contrast what an inspired book looks like by comparing it to something that somebody claims is inspired and is clearly of a lower class. Not that that's not a good point. That's a really good point. All right, okay, so what about 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees? Of the Apocrypha, there's one book that, to me, I cannot tell that it's not inspired. Okay, that's 1 Maccabees. The theology of 1 Maccabees is correct, as far as I can tell. The history of 1 Maccabees, as far as I know from Josephus and other writings, is accurate. And it might even be inspired. Are there inspired writings not included in the Bible? Yeah, of course there are. I mean, the apostles taught with authority. They taught with inspiration. All right. I assume that I know they said things that were inspired. They probably wrote things that were inspired. Something that was, in quotes, inspired, not included in the Bible, who cares? Who cares? You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have any meaning. So I do not know if 1 Maccabees is inspired or not, but I'll say this. As you're reading the Apocrypha, I believe when you get to 1 Maccabees, you're kind of like, you're back, oh, okay, this is like 1 and 2 Kings. It's a high-quality thing that if it were accepted in the Bible, you wouldn't say, wow, that kind of confuses the whole inspiration thing. Got it? So you might want to read it. It's a fascinating story. Now, 2 Maccabees is clearly not inspired. Clearly not inspired. And unlike 1 Maccabees, it has some obvious historical errors. All right, and that's worth noting. For example, in 2 Maccabees 6:17, he says, "Without further ado, we must go on with our story." Can you imagine something like that being in the Bible? Without further ado, you know, let us go on with our story. And how about at the end of 2 Maccabees chapter 15? "I'll bring my own story to an end here too. If it is well written and to the point, that is what I wanted. If it is poorly done and mediocre, that is the best I could do." All right. Again, not inspired, obviously not inspired. And I believe it really puts a light on what we mean when we say that the Bible is inspired by God. Okay, then there's Wisdom and Ecclesiasticus. These are kind of pseudepigraphal, although their titles don't contain the name Solomon. Both claim to have been written by Solomon, and both certainly were not written by Solomon. Now, could a couple of legitimate proverbs that Solomon wrote have ended up in these books? Maybe. There's no way to know that. I can't prove it's not true. But what I can say is true. There are things in these books that were not written by Solomon. And they're written in an elegant Greek style. It doesn't show any evidence of having come from a Hebrew source. So it's like Proverbs. It's technically part of the pseudepigrapha. By the way, pseudepigrapha means false attribution, false letter. In other words, something that's claimed to be written by somebody who certainly didn't write it. For example, the Gospel of Judas would be a pseudepigrapha. First Enoch, obviously not written by Enoch, you know, things like that. Okay, and there's some pretty good advice in here. It's really more worldly advice. All right, but nevertheless, I would say if you read either of these, you could probably put 2/3 of it on one side and say, all right, okay, you know, and then another third, which is worldly advice, which you kind of go, I don't know. And then a few things you go, no. All right, but it's clearly not inspired. Here's an example of a pretty good one. It's in Ecclesiasticus. Envy and anger shorten one's life. Worry brings on premature age. One who is cheerful and gay will at table benefits from his food. That could be in Proverbs. I mean, why not? If there are many with you at the table, be not the first one to reach out your hand. All right, that sounds good. Okay. But there's other things. For example, this one here in Ecclesiasticus 19, verse 7. Tell nothing to a friend or foe. If you have a fault, reveal it not. Okay. Yes. Let me see. Water quenches a flaming fire, and alms atone for sins. Oh, do you see why the Roman Catholic Church likes these? That one is Ecclesiasticus. I'm calling it Sirach here. Ecclesiasticus, if you look, if you find it, it's right here. It's the next one after Wisdom. All right. It's the technical name is Ecclesiasticus, but it's also called the Wisdom of Jesus ben Sirach. So many people call it Sirach. Okay, so I'm using both terms here. All right. Worst of all wounds is that of the heart. Worst of all evils is that of a woman. There is scarce any evil like that in a woman. May she fall to be the lot of the sinner. All right, that's kind of problematic. Right? Both men and women in this room are both offended, I hope. All right, got it? And in fact, if you think about it, it's amazing that there are no disrespectful things said about women in the entire Bible. None.
Very patriarchal, too.
There are no disrespectful things said about women in the entire Bible. That alone is evidence that it's inspired by God. Because read any writings by anybody, including Jews and unfortunately even Christians in the early church, and you'll find these things, you know, dropped little bombs here and there. All right, so again, this is not inspired. Got it? All right, next in my notes, I mentioned other extra-biblical writings such as 1st Esdras, 2nd Esdras, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Enoch, etc. And these are other writings. You know, you can read them for yourself. 1st Enoch is stories about the angels and how the angels came down and interbred with women, and that created the Nephilim. And these are Jewish fables that I know for a fact Jewish people believe in. And some Christians believe that these might be useful information, certainly in understanding how Jews thought about their own writings, and might possibly even provide actual information. I don't know. I don't care, to be honest with you. I mean, I care as a person who wants to know what I'm talking about and be aware of scholarship, but I think we can ignore those because, again, we're only looking at these things in order to show what an inspired book looks like. So let's go to the New Testament Apocrypha. If that term is so loose, it's hard to know how to use. But the New Testament Apocrypha would be documents written by in the early church that at least some people considered possibly for inclusion in the New Testament.
John, what about the book of Jasher, which is mentioned in Joshua?
It doesn't exist anymore.
So it's lost?
Right. It's just a historical source. So just like Luke used sources. He even told us he used sources. And the writers of 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Samuel used sources. And they even list their sources. Thank you for doing that. Were their sources inspired or not? I don't know. There's more than the Book of the Annals of the Kings of Judah and all these things. There are a number of documents that the Old Testament writers, especially the history writers, mention. So they're using sources. Thank you for using sources. That's a good idea. It partially explains why their history is accurate, also because they were inspired, but I believe God, you know, was behind all that. So anyway, books which that the early church, some early church fathers supported possibly as sub-canonical. And by the way, you have to understand, for the Jews didn't have, we have a very linear, scientific, Western mindset. Either it's inspired or it's not. What do you mean more inspired and less inspired? That's craziness to us. But to the Jews, that's not crazy. To the Jews, the Torah was the highest level. And then the writings and the prophets were also inspired, but they might have, in some sense that's hard for us to get, might have thought them as a slightly less level of inspired. And so they might have considered some of these other Jewish writings as being kind of a third level. And we consider them, therefore, not inspired. Okay, got it? And so for the early church to have used these books is not as crazy as it would seem to us. You know, because to us, it's obviously, look, it's either inspired or it's not. What are you talking about? And so that could apply to explain why Shepherd of Hermas, Epistle of Barnabas, why I have that. Here we go. Here's my list. I believe this is the full list of ones that were actually considered, at least by some people having written down, as being inspired. Shepherd of Hermas, Epistle of Barnabas, Didache, First Clement. That's it. All right, yeah.
I just was curious. You mentioned the first level being the highest, or canonical.
No. I said for the Jews, the first level is the Torah, the Pentateuch.
Oh, okay. Beyond, okay.
And for the Jews, at least for some Jews, they would have put the writings as being absolutely inspired, but still to have authority, a slightly graded less authority. We don't see it that way, but I'm telling you, some Jews thought of it that way.
I'm just wondering, is this table first, second, or third level?
Yeah. Fourth. Yeah. You're just setting up a joke. All right, there you go.
Question.
Yeah, okay, that's good. Yes?
I was thinking that when you read the New Testament, you see how the Sadducees and Pharisees are fighting about doctrine. You
know, right.
Is there a resurrection? Right. Are there angels? No, yes. I have to remember that the Sadducees considered the Torah, the first five
right.
books, like, wow, this is it. This is what we're going to use.
Right.
And then the Pharisees were, using Isaiah and all these other
right.
biblical books, and so that was a lot of why they were fighting with each other, because of this kind of concept of hierarchy.
Right, and so that's, thank you, that's further evidence to support what I'm saying here. And the Samaritans also only used the Pentateuch. But I think even the Jews in Jesus' camp, from Jesus' side of the Jewish spectrum, probably would have seen some difference, probably. Yeah. But by the way, did Jesus consider all these other books inspired, the ones that are in our Old Testament? Well, yeah, he quoted from them. He quoted from Isaiah. He quoted from Jeremiah, Psalms. He quoted from all these books. He just, just a shotgun approach, essentially, to the Old Testament. Yes?
So this first paragraph, that looks like a quote. Is that a quote from one of the church fathers?
Yes. Yes. Origen said that. Yes, and I had a list. I gave you a list. It's earlier in my notes. Two of these were appended to, one of them to the Sinaiticus, the other one to Alexandrinus. So we have a record, physical record, of some of these being included essentially in the Bible, the New Testament, by certain people. All right, got it? So let's go through this list. I'm not going to do the whole list. Epistle of Barnabas, possibly late 1st century, certainly by the early 2nd century. And it uses a form of interpretation we call allegory, which is a very, very dubious interpretation of the Old Testament. There's a diatribe against the Jews, which is, I would say, inappropriate. Okay. So anyway, read the Epistle of Barnabas. If a quick first reading, and it kind of sounds almost like it could be inspired, but then if you read it carefully, you kind of go, no, definitely not. Didache, do I treat with the Didache here? No, I don't. The Didache probably is late first century. probably late first century. And it was a catechism. All right? And there are things in there that imply that baptism only forgives sin committed before you were baptized, not after. So there's some false doctrine there, I believe. All right? And also it says baptism in running water is best, still water, fine, but if not, pouring. And, you know, I'm not going to say one way or another that if somebody was poured instead of immersed that they're going to go to hell or something like that. But that to me, it represents a moving away from a strict, the kind of things you find in the New Testament. So Didache, Shepherd of Hermas, very allegorized, using the Old Testament in ways that's kind of like, seriously? Are you kidding? No, that is a stretch. And we don't see that. We don't see the New Testament writers kind of pushing the Old Testament in ways that have you scratching your head like, ah, come on, that's really pushing it. Hopefully our preachers don't do that at church either. Okay, hopefully not. All right, so you asked about the other, right? What time is it, by the way?
9:45.
All right, good. I'm doing my... So what about these other Gospels? All right, there were several, dozens of writings, actually. The Nag Hammadi Library was found in Nag Hammadi, all right, and it was a treasure trove of Gnostic writings, all right, and included not everything that is in our list of Gnostic writings, because we have other sources. We know that some of these go back as early as the 2nd century. It's been estimated that the Gospel of Thomas might have been written as early as 140 A.D. Okay. Others certainly were written during the 2nd century. We can say for sure Gospel of Judas was, because it's quoted by Irenaeus in the late 2nd century. Most of these other, in quotes, Gospels, which are, by the way, not Gospels at all, as I'll explain, these things were written, other than Thomas, which might be slightly earlier than this date, they were written between 150 and 250 A.D., more or less. Okay, these were written in Greek, although some may have been originally written in something like Coptic, maybe, I don't know. Probably all originally in Greek. Now, let's talk about this. First of all, even the Gnostics never used these. All right. What I mean is when they were preaching, when they were writing their letters and their epistles and trying to get people to be Gnostics and believe in all this heretical stuff, even they don't use these writings. So even they did not consider them inspired. And if you read them, and I'm going to have a few short quotes, you can see why they would be laughed off the stage. All right. If they were to start reading some of these things, it might have worked in their inner circle of converts to their Gnostic teaching, but in the front of the whole church, they would have been laughed off the stage for several reasons. First and foremost, because none of these were apostolic. You could argue, you could say that maybe Didache, possibly the apostles or the immediate companion of the apostles, might have said, yes, you should read this book. All right? Maybe they did. I don't know. But nobody... Nobody in the early church, even the Gnostics, would have had the nerve to say that the Gospel of Thomas would have been supported by the apostles or the immediate successor of the apostles.
Yeah,
okay?
Thomas double misleading. It's neither gospel or by Thomas.
Yeah, right. Yes.
So John, is part of the reason for that because they were written between 150 and 250 and these people
right.
being a lot earlier than that? Is that part of it too?
Well, like I already said, in the debates with their Gnostic enemies, if you want to call that. And by the way, you have to understand, there was really only one church to go to back then. So in the second century, people that we would consider heretics were attending church. All right, that's something that, it's hard to imagine, but true. All right, and so people, it'd be kind of like having Jehovah's Witnesses be at our church, even being a member. But it seems that was the case. And so they would, the people would have discussions and debates. And like I said, some of these Gnostics had their verses, and that what I believe the Orthodox true Christians had their verses, But they won their arguments most easily by saying, but the apostles never taught that. All right, and those, because in the middle second century, there were people alive who had at least known some apostles. Not many, but there were. So for somebody to get up on the stage and defend these Gnostic teachings by saying that these are apostolic, that people would have laughed at them. Okay? So, but again, our point is not that necessarily. Our point is read these things. And so I'm going to read some quotes from these things, and we're going to kind of go, seriously, no wonder. So not just because of the terrible quality, but in the early church, because they clearly were not apostolic and didn't have apostolic authority. Okay? But, you know, maybe if somebody could write something that didn't have apostolic authority that's still inspired. I don't know. Read them for yourself. All right. So here are some quotes from the Gospel of Thomas. Let Mary go away from us, because women are not worthy of life. Quoting Jesus. No. Sorry. So this is Peter. This is Peter, and then I'll read Jesus' response. Yes. So Peter says to Jesus, let Mary go away from us because women are not worthy of life. Jesus responds, he says, he will make Mary male so that she may enter the kingdom of heaven.
Wow.
All right.
Wow.
All right. Yeah. And so people who attack the inspiration and reliability of the New Testament are saying this is evidence because, you know, how do you even know which is which and blah, blah, blah. It's like these books and it's confusing. But you can't have it both ways. Now, you can't have it both ways. You can't say that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are in the same, group with these things here and then use that as evidence that, therefore, they're not inspired because they're clearly not in this group. Okay, and to say that they are is really, I mean, come on. You can't take that seriously. So in the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus is turning clay pigeons into birds and they fly off. And this, of course, is mentioned in the Quran. And in the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus in the cradle, you know, right there in the scene, when he's born, is saying to Mary, yes, I'm going to be the Messiah and I'm going to save the world. And I mean, I don't, you know, come on. These are fairy tale kinds of stuff. By the way, if you read the Gospel of Thomas, again, I would say a third to half of it sound like things that Jesus said. Some of them are what Jesus said because he's quoting the Gospels. And it's believed that it's possible some of the content in Thomas is legitimate tradition from the first century of things Jesus said that aren't in the New Testament. That is possible. It is possible that there are things in the Gospel of Thomas, because it's the highest quality of all these. Of all these Gnostic writings, it's the highest quality one by far, despite this stuff. Okay? And it is possible that there are sayings in the Gospel of Thomas that are legitimate sayings of Jesus that are not in the New Testament. But it's not inspired. And are there things Jesus said that aren't in the New Testament? Yeah, like 3 years, what do you think? Possibly. All right, so let me see. Here's a quote from the Gospel of Philip. Eshemoth is one thing and Eshmoth another. Eshemoth is wisdom, simply. But Eshemoth is the wisdom of death, which is the one who knows death, which is called the little wisdom. All right, okay, sure, whatever you say, you know, whatever you say. All right, here's another quote from the Gospel of Philip. God is a man-eater. For this reason, men are sacrificed to him. Before men were... But by the way, what they're doing is they're attacking... No, it's not up there. They're attacking the Old Testament by saying it's very physical. This is a typical Gnostic attack, just like the Gospel of Judas. All right, it has Jesus kissing Mary on the lips, Mary Magdalene on the lips, and implying he had a romantic relationship with Mary Magdalene. All right? Okay, that's disgusting. Okay. So, Now what I'm going to talk about is other religions. Now, I'm only going to do a little bit of this. So, again, the point is this. When you read the New Testament, people say, oh, you know, it's not inspired. It has all these mistakes. It has science errors. It has history errors. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. But then other evidence of its inspiration is that basically I believe the Bible is the standard that defines what we even mean by inspiration. The fact that that a Hindu would even think to say that the Rig Veda or the Bhagavad Gita is inspired, they wouldn't even use that language or even talk in that way if we didn't already have the concept of inspiration even existing. All right, and so I'm going to claim that Buddhist and Hindu writings, you know, even those who wrote them didn't think of them as being inspired. They're just philosophy and poetry. All right, so the very concept of having inspired writing derives itself from the Bible. That's my point. Okay, so it's time to take our break. Thank you. So we'll do that. That'll be the second half. And the last 2 weeks will be the really important part of the class, the reason you came, which is defending the reliability and inspiration of the Bible. So you have to come to the last two classes. Okay. So Jan says sign up. Okay. The recorder is now on. And again, like I said, the very concept of an inspired text derives itself from the Old and New Testament. So everyone who claims that their supposed writings or authoritative thing is somehow authoritative has to compare themselves to the Bible. And the reason I know that is because that's what they all do. So we're going to see that. We're going to see, because we did a debate on Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, and this guy was in the unfortunate position, the imam, was in the unfortunate position of having to defend the Quran against the Old and New Testament. That's not a good position to be in an open debate. But the form of his defense was a defense like the defense that we use. All right? And, you know, you can make your point if you want to later on. So we're going to, now, a lot of this stuff, how many went to the class on Islam last spring? All right, only two of you, well, Jan, yeah, Jan, of course. What a shock. All right, so some of this is repeating that, so I don't want to spend too much time here. So we're going to talk about Islam, Baha'i, Mormonism, Hinduism, and Buddhism, and the supposed scriptures of these religions, and kind of compare them to the scriptures that we use. And again, these scriptures, in quotes, make the Bible look amazing. Like you or I trying to, you know, long jump against the world record holder, kind of like that. All right, so Muslim apologists tried to defend the Quran. And they're forced. If it weren't for Christianity, they wouldn't have to do this. But they're forced to defend the Quran as inspired by Allah. Because Christians mention the things such as fulfilled prophecies, historical accuracy, scientific accuracy, etc. So Muslims are forced to defend their scriptures along the lines that I guarantee you they wouldn't prefer to do. All right? But so they claim they have a perfectly reliable text, which is hard to tell. We'll talk about that. They claim to support belief in that it's inspired because of numerology, because of scientific accuracy, because of the beauty of the Arabic text, and because of fulfilled prophecy. That somehow fell off of the slide, because they claim to have fulfilled prophecy in their book. Okay? But really, in the end, when push comes to shove, if you talk to Muslim apologists, they always revert to one thing and one thing only, which is attempts to undermine the believability of the Bible. They just want to shift the direction of the discussion. kind of like in a certain debate that happened not recently where he kept wanting to shift it to something else. Because on that one topic, you know, forgive me for making up a little, but on that one topic, it's an uncomfortable topic. You see what I'm saying? Somebody want to shift it to something else. So they want to put it back on attacking the Bible, which they don't do a very good job of unless they're only talking to one another, but that's what they're doing. So I'll talk about that a bit. I shouldn't even have thrown out a political thing, but, you know. All right, so they claim that their text of the Quran is perfect, inerrant. They make claims about the Quran that are fairly similar to the kinds of claims we make about the Bible. All right, but unfortunately, they make a mistake that I've warned us not to do, which is to make claims that are, you know, don't make too strong of a claim. Don't paint yourself into the corner. Don't, you know, keep something back in your... in your bag or whatever, and don't overstate your evidence. Don't create a stronger picture than the one you could defend with a perfectly clear conscience in front of people who know what they're talking about. Okay, got it? So they claim it's without error, but the problem is this: there was, I believe, it's the fourth caliph. Maybe the third, the fourth caliph, Uthman, what he did was he created a single text of the Quran. So there were many divergent texts, something like, I guess, say, the Greek New Testament in the second or third century. There were many different texts. The list of surahs, which would be their chapters, were different. Some of the quotes were different. And it was creating confusion. Unfortunately, he did what fortunately for us, the New Testament leaders never did, which was he collected them all and burned them. So he attempted to solve the problem of textual variation by covering it up. All right, and I would say I think a sincere Muslim might have thought that was a good thing. Okay, and so it wasn't even necessarily cynical even when he did it. It may very well be that he actually believed in the Quran and he wanted to create the single best Arabic, you know, Quran and for the people. However, the effect of it was to cause us to not be able to figure out what the original Quran looked like. That's the problem, okay?
What kind of evidence do we have that happened?
It's in the Hadith. The Hadith is kind of the subcanonical Muslim writing. So the inspired writings of Islam are the Quran and then the Hadith. Now, there are five main Hadith, and then there are other ones in other writings. And so if you listen to Imam's teaching, they teach from the Hadith as much as from the Quran. And it's recorded. In fact, we have there's five copies of the original Uthmanic manuscripts, he had a number made, that are still in existence. All right? So, and all Muslims will tell you that they all, this is common knowledge. Common knowledge.
What century is that?
It was done in 650-something. 650, the early 650s.
They still have those manuscripts?
Yes.
So they can argue their manuscripts are closer to the original.
Well, no, I would say... the manuscript evidence for the Quran, in terms of the number and quality, is similar to the manuscript evidence for the New Testament. The problem is competing manuscripts were eliminated. All right, and so it makes it harder to attempt to do what we can do, which is textual criticism, to try to reproduce the original. But I would say... If Muslims get up and say the Quran we're reading is essentially what was, or they say exactly, if they would do what they ought to do, which is say essentially the same as was originally written, then I'd say it's true. I would say the Quran that is used by Muslims today is about as reliable as the Greek New Testament. Okay? But unfortunately, that's not what they say, which is a problem for them. Again, but that's not the main point. I don't want to spend too much time on this because our point is to look at the Quran itself and see if it's inspired, all right? So the problems of the Quran in terms of that, the textual stuff, is a minor side note for us. All right, but anyway, so the problem is a couple of these variant texts did survive. That's the problem. So there's the Sana'a manuscript. It says AD 710. I need to change that. It was dated by carbon 14 to between 635 and 685. So take the middle, around 660. So around the time of the Uthmanic texts, this Sana'a manuscript was made. And there are a number of variations, most of them minor, but there are also two surahs in the Sana'a manuscript that are not included in the Uthmanic Quran. So again, I would say, within a factor of two or three or four or so, the evidence for the reliability of the Quran is similar to the New Testament in terms of it being reflecting what was originally written. There's also the Tashkent manuscript from 850. It's actually a non-Uthmanic manuscript. A few survived. This was made later, and there are many, many textual variants. But like I said, there's a number of textual variants in the New Testament. So I'm going to go on to the next thing. Here's a nice quote from Bevan Jones. He said, "While it may be that no other work has remained for 12 centuries with so pure text, Quran, true statement, it's also equally true that no other has suffered such a drastic purging. Also true." So their claims that it's exact is really hard to test because they got rid of all the evidence. They covered it up. But the little evidence we have, which is not much, shows that it is not true. It is a lie. It's an actual lie. It's not. There's no question about it. It's a lie to say that there is no, there's no changes that happened, because they did. We know that it did. Okay. Anyway. Now, in defending the purity of the text, the Muslim apologists don't even acknowledge this evidence. For example, when the Sana'a manuscript came out, it wasn't that long ago, I think in the 90s or early 2000s, they tried to get Muslim scholars to analyze it, and none of them would. Because if you were to do that, you would be, somebody would kill you. All right? They don't just claim that there are no changes, they'll threaten to kill you if you say it was changed, especially if you're a Muslim. So it took... for us, like, we don't like non-Christian unbelievers to even talk about the Bible very much, because they tend to treat it disrespectfully. What can I say? They can, they have every right to, but, I don't really necessarily like to read their scholarship, kind of. But the Muslims, if they ever did want to read about these things, are stuck reading things written about them by non-Muslims, because Muslims basically pretend. They literally pretend they don't exist. And for good reason. Because you'd get killed if you did something different. So the Muslim apologists tried to attack the New Testament, saying it's corrupt, and yet they claim that their scripture is not corrupt, and they ignore all the evidence that it is corrupt. Well, what kind of debate is that? So they pretend there's no evidence. They don't use the evidence to try to create a perfect text, which is the exact opposite of the attitude of Christians towards their text. Because we have thousands of manuscripts, and scholars go over these things with fine-tooth combs. And so I would say, ironically, if anything, we probably have a better Greek New Testament than they have Arab Quran, simply because they refuse to do textual criticism. It's not even a science. There's no such thing as textual criticism. It's true. You don't like it, we'll kill you. All right, there you go. Well, that really settles that argument, but not to a reasonable person. So, Christians spend a lot of time and energy trying to create a reliable text because they admit the obvious truth that there are mistakes in the copies. All right, got it? So, now, what's interesting is in the Quran, it says that the Old and New Testament are inspired. So, that's worth noting. All right? And they also say... They call it the Injil, or the Evangelion, the Gospel. In Surah 547, it says, not to Muslims, but to believers in God, other than Muslims, it says, you need to follow the Injil, follow the Gospel. In other words, read it and do what it says. So Muhammad in the 7th century says the New Testament as it now exists in Christian hands is inspired. Read it. All right? And so this is 300 years after this, the Sinaitic text and all those. So we have these things. But the problem is the New Testament says things that contradict the Quran in the starkest possible terms. I mean, they can't both be true, obviously. All right, so that's a little bit problematic, you see. So that's why Muslims go after the New Testament so strongly. Because if the New Testament is accurate, then Islam is nonsense. Got it? Yeah.
So what they're saying is, okay, so their Quran is saying that the inspired writings of Christianity are correct.
Yes.
The problem is they're saying you don't have the inspired writings of Christianity.
Right. That's not what the Quran says, but that's what Muslims today say.
Because that exists in the Quran.
Right. And the reason is that is not noted by Muhammad is it seems that he didn't have access to the New Testament. He did have access to Christianity, but the evidence is it was a corrupted Christianity. As I'll mention, some of the things that are quoted in the Quran come from things like the Gospel of Thomas. All right, got it? Yeah.
But how do we know that Muhammad was quoted as saying, telling followers?
Because right here, all right, you can read Surah 547. Just pull out any Quran you want, and it says that. And according to the Quran and according to Muslims, these are the words of Muhammad himself. Here's another quote. The people of the Injil shall rule in accordance with Allah's revelation therein. Anyone who does not rule in accordance with Allah's revelations, these are the wicked. I have to check. I think I'm quoting Surah 547. But I need to improve my slide. I may or may not. There are a number of statements in the Quran that say that the Old and New Testament are inspired. Okay? As in the Quran. Nobody can doubt that. I mean, you know, we have texts of the Quran from within less than 50 years of when Muhammad died. I mean, there's no question that he taught this. Okay? And Muslims are aware of this. They know this. All right? They say the Quran is unchanged, but we know for a fact that it is. Their defense of its being unchanged is to say, because we say so. All right, that's not a very good defense. And also, Muslims are told to obey the Old. By the way, this is obey the New Testament. This is obey the Old Testament. You can look up these surahs. All right, those are all right. So these are surahs where it says to obey what's written in the Old Testament. And this is, I believe this is 547 where he's saying to obey the New Testament. Okay? So he's saying that they're inspired. You know, it's essentially that he's saying they're inspired. Okay, got it? But that creates a problem for Islam, to say the least, a huge problem.
John, you want me to read Surah 547?
Am I getting it right?
And the people of the gospel judge by what Allah has revealed therein. And whoever does not judge by what Allah has revealed, then it is those who are the defiantly disobedient.
Right. So basically, we Christians, according to Muhammad, ought to obey the New Testament gospel as it existed in the 7th century. And we have manuscripts from 300 years before that, or even 500 and 600 years before that. Okay? So is that clear? All right, great. So now, and one of the supports for the supposed reliability of the Quran is that it's fulfilling prophecies in the Old Testament. And again, I believe they're doing this at least in part because they realize there's prophecy fulfillment in the New Testament, or at least it's claimed. So they have to say, well, we got that too. Got that too. So, for example, Deuteronomy 18, 15 through 18. The Lord, let me see. Yeah. The Lord will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your brothers. You must listen to him, for this is what you asked of the Lord our God at Horeb in the day of assembly when you said, let us not hear the voice of the Lord our God, nor see this great fire anymore, or we will die. The Lord said to me, what they say is good. I'll raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. I'll put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command him. And, of course, that's Muhammad. That's a prophecy of Muhammad. So they're saying the life of Muhammad is a fulfillment of Deuteronomy 18. Now, is the life of Muhammad a fulfillment of Deuteronomy 18? Is Muhammad like Moses? Well, I mean, you know, I guess so. But he's certainly not amongst the brothers. He's certainly not a Jew. All right? He's certainly not a Jew. Mm-hmm. All right? To me, it's quite obviously a prophecy about Jesus. Who fulfills this prophecy better, Jesus or Muhammad? Come on, give me a break. This only works if you have an audience of Muslims only. It's the only audience that this works. So now, but here's the point. I'm not trying. My job, at least supposedly, is not to undermine this. My job is to show that the claim of inspiration of Islam of the Quran is based on, for one thing, that it's fulfilling prophecies, trying to use the analogy of the New Testament. All right, and my point is that the Bible is the standard. It's the gold standard. In fact, it's the only standard for what it means to even be inspired. And yet they need to undercut it, but use that same standard to establish their own inspiration. It's kind of, these people are in a bad place. All right, so other things, Isaiah 21:7, when he sees riders on donkeys or riders on camels, let them be fully alert. They claim the riders on donkeys are the Christians because Jesus rode in on a donkey. And the riders on camels, that's Muhammad, because he rode on a camel. All right, but then you can read the context of Isaiah 21, verse 7, and he's talking about the fall of Babylon. It's not even a messianic prophecy. All right, so there's your awesome fulfillment of prophecy. And we have things in the New Testament like betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, born in Bethlehem, came from Galilee, crucified. I mean, these are the prophecies fulfilled in the New Testament, and this is the equivalent awesome support for the inspiration of the Quran. And then the most famous, of course, is John 14:16, where it says, I'm going to send a helper, or a counselor, if you will. And they claim that the original Greek was not parakletos, but it's actually parakletos, the praised one. So basically, Jesus is saying, I'm going to send the praised one. Peace be upon him, praise be upon him. That's a prophecy of the Muhammad, rather than the Holy Spirit. There's a few problems with that, because two verses later he says, I'm going to send the Holy Spirit. He says, I'm going to send the counselor, and then he says, I'm going to send the Holy Spirit. And they say, actually, there's a textual mistake. It's actually parakletos. The problem with this is they're living in an evidence-free zone. In other words, there are no manuscripts that have this reading. So they're claiming that when our Greek New Testament, which says counselor, that's actually a corruption of the original, which was praised one, which, you know, praised one applied to the Holy Spirit, I guess would work. So anyway, you get the point. This claim that the Quran contains fulfilled prophecy is based on these three examples, which are, forgive me, but I'm sorry, but they're ludicrous. They really are. Okay? Next, they also claim to have scientific accuracy. And, oh, you'll hear it. You'll hear Muslim apologists getting up there and giving these seminars. And by the way, Muslims do a pretty good job of doing these Quran evidences classes to prepare their believers, because they realize they're going to come up against Christians. All right? And they have their conferences. And they'll say, make statements like, the Bible has all kinds of science errors, which they're cutting themselves off at the feet because Muhammad said it's inspired. But they say similarly, that's the thing, is that they don't know which side to argue here. In the same way, but not in the same way, the Quran is scientifically accurate. But in Surah 21:33, it says the sun and the stars orbit the earth. Okay. I don't know. What do you think about that? Is that true? Did the sun and the stars orbit the earth? Now, the Bible does say things like the sun rose and set, using the common language of the day, By the way, if you're going to get the Bible on being scientifically accurate or inaccurate in that, then you should never say, I went to watch the sunset. You should have said, I went to watch the earth turn away from the sun. I mean, you know. So if you want to call that a science error, feel free. But the difference is, in Surah 21:33, it's making a concrete statement of fact. That's wrong. All right. Also, the Quran incorporates the cosmology, the false Greek cosmology of the crystal sphere, and the stars are embedded in the crystal sphere, and they circle the earth at the farthest distance, and then there's various heavenly objects closer and farther, the sun, the moon, the planets. And so Surah 41, verse 12 and verse 127, heaven, stars, and comets are in the lowest heaven. There's different levels of heaven. This whole false cosmology. And by the way, the Old Testament, to some extent, uses the language of the false cosmology, but it doesn't give the false cosmology. All right, got it? So the Bible does not have patently false statements like this. Surah 34:9 and 52:44, a piece of the sky falls and hits somebody and kills them. Like Chicken Little, or what's the one with the... Yeah, right, Chicken Little. All right. Also, there's this bizarre fable of these kids going into a cave and coming out 400 years later. And then Surah 36:4 that basically says the man deposits the baby inside the woman, which it was the common thought even in Europe as late as the 17th century, that, you know, that the woman has no part other than being an incubator. So there are significant science errors in the Quran, all right, which, in my opinion, undermines its inspiration. All right. Creation from a clot of blood. By the way, they tout this one all the time as proof that the Quran accurately describes the gestation of a fetus. You can read it for yourself. Really? I don't know. Then we made the sperm into a clot of congealed blood. From that clot, we made a lump, and we made out of that lump bones. I mean, they're claiming that this is a scientifically accurate description of how the child forms in the womb. But as far as I know, probably actually the sperm is not a clot of congealed blood. But anyway, also in Surah 18:86, these people travel to the west, and they find the place where the sun sets. And it sets into a muddy swamp. All right, so that's a little bit problematic for the inspiration of the Quran. And again, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it does point out conflict with the New Testament example. All right, there are historical errors in the Quran. Now, again, this is assuming that the Bible got it right, and therefore it'd be an error. I suppose you could argue that the Quran got it right, possibly. But two problems with that, which is Muhammad says that the Old Testament is accurate. Second of all, they're different. And I don't know, who's more likely to get it right? Somebody writing 100 years later or somebody writing 1,600 years later? Common sense. Just come on, folks, common sense. All right. So according to the Quran, Abraham went with Ishmael on a pilgrimage to the Kaaba there in Mecca. The Quran confuses Ishmael with Isaac. The Quran specifically says only one tree in the garden. In the Quran, Noah's fourth son drowns in the flood. In the Quran, Zechariah is silent for 3 days rather than 9 months. Possibly. But that means that the person, say Luke, got it wrong. And Luke probably talked to people who knew Mary and knew Jesus. So, all right, I mean, I suppose possibly Luke got it wrong. But if that's true, then that conflicts your claim that we should read the Evangelion, that it's reliable. And it's just not particularly believable that Muhammad would get it right. You know, I guess it doesn't prove it, but it seems kind of a little fishy. Okay, got it? And then, of course, it has these bogus miracles of Jesus' childhood that are taken clearly from the Gospel of Thomas, but not from the four Gospels. Okay, good. The theory of abrogation. Again, in the Quran, there are places where Muhammad admits that he got it wrong. In other words, basically, things that were said earlier, Muhammad himself admits they were wrong and says we have to change that now. So there's this entire doctrine of abrogation that Muslims don't want to talk about. There's this entire doctrine of abrogation that Muslims talking to one another discuss all the time. They're scholars. They don't talk about it with their regular folks, and they certainly don't talk about it in discussions with us. All right, but so in the Quran, like I said, there are statements similar to what the New Testament says about its reliability. No one can alter it. No one can change it. There's no change in the promise of Allah. But then in Surah 2, it says, none of our revelations do we abrogate or cause to be forgotten, but we substitute something better or similar. All right? So right there in Surah 2, Muhammad's admitting that, you know, there were some things that we had to change and replace, but it's because it's better. So can you imagine the equivalent thing in the New Testament? Saying, yeah, you know, it turns out it's not actually true that fill in the blank, you know, but it's still in the Bible. The thing that they abrogate is still in the Bible, but don't pay attention to it. This is the new thing. All right, and there are a number of cases in the Quran where Muhammad corrects himself. So my question is, well, was the first thing inspired then? What's the definition of inspiration in that case? All right, got it? So, and by the way, Muslims have discussed this in great detail, and they have all agreed anything that was said later, in quotes, abrogates what was said before. So in other words, if what was said before, it conflicts what was said later, which never happens in the Old Testament or New Testament ever, but clearly happens in the Quran, because the writer of the Quran even admits that it happens. So it's not just a matter of us critics finding contradictions like they try to do with the Bible, but them admitting it. So there you go. So in a moment of weakness, Surah 53:19, Muhammad said, have you thought of Al-Lat, Al-Uzza, and Al-Manat? Here, Muhammad actually said that these three other idols in Mecca, they might actually be gods. Yeah, it's good. Thank you for being wide-eyed. Thank you. Her look was like, you're kidding. You know. So Muhammad had a weak moment. And he wrote down, and it even explains what was going on there. This was in Mecca when he was under great threat of, you know, being kicked out or killed or whatever for rejecting the others. And he said, well, you know, they are exalted intermediaries. Really? Okay, if you say so. All right. And these are sometimes called the satanic verses. And there's a certain guy, Salman Rushdie, who has got a, what do you call it, a fatwa.
A death threat.
For saying what's true. I mean, it's true. I mean, the guy is biased against Islam. Okay, that's true. He's got a bone to pick, so you can't blame him for being mad at him. Okay, I understand that. But the idea that Muhammad acknowledged these idols as being intermediaries between us and Allah, they can't debate that. Well, they could, but the problem is it's in the Quran. Now, there are other satanic verses that were removed, and that's debatable. All right, so there are other verses that were originally in the Quran, maybe. We could debate that. All right, but some of these satanic verses are still in there. All right, anyway, for example, earlier in the Quran, you had to pray towards Jerusalem. And then after he left Mecca and went to Medina, now you pray towards Mecca. That's an abrogation. So the command is to pray towards Jerusalem, and it's been abrogated. Well, you could say, well, the New Testament abrogates the Old Testament, if you want to say that. All right. But no, that's not, Jesus says, not a jot or a tittle will remove. He says it's all inspired. And he basically said, if you're a Jew, you need to obey those things. However, the new covenant is a new covenant. So for those under the new covenant, they're not under the old covenant. All right. There's a surah that says no more than four wives for any follower of Allah. And then there's a surah that abrogated that, say, well, Muhammad's an exception. Okay, so that basic, who knows how many he had. There's he had a lot of them, including one he married when she was 8. He didn't consummate the marriage until she was 11, so give him a little bit of credit there. All right, that's a problem. Yeah.
So do Muslims, do they read the Quran? I mean, is that something like they?
No, they don't read the Quran because they can't.
What do you mean by they can't?
Well, because it's in a language that nobody speaks anymore.
So they only get to hear what is preached.
Right. They hear it recited, and then they hear interpretation. Uh-huh. It's roughly analogous to say being a Lutheran or a Catholic who never reads the Bible but hears a lot of sermons from the Bible. So that's what Muslims get. Even Arab-speaking Muslims can't read the Quran because the Quran is in a form of Arabic that's far more unreadable to the Arab reader today than, say, King James is for us. So they don't read it. Now, of course, there are Muslim scholars. Absolutely, there are Muslim scholars that spend a lot of time. You know, they study the ancient Arabic and they go into great depth, and there are very, in-depth, very scholarly, very knowledgeable scholars of the Quran. But the average Muslim does not read the Quran. They only hear it recited in a language that they don't understand.
How about the English and then, versions of the Quran? Do they read the English versions of the Quran? Some do, some don't.
I would imagine that probably more Christians read the English translation than Muslims, but I don't really know. That's another thing I shouldn't have said, probably, but it may actually be true. It may actually be true. So there are translations, but it is official doctrine of Islam that you're not supposed to be reading those things because they believe that only that it's a corruption, right? Okay, got it. Also, another thing that's a bit disturbing is. There are many verses in the Quran that imply that Muslims should treat people of the book respectfully and give them a certain level of political freedom. And those are the earlier ones. The later ones are the ones that say basically kill them all and cut off their heads and that kind of stuff. So by that abrogation principle, it's the violent passages in the Quran that abrogate the peaceful ones. Which is a little concerning. Okay, good.
Muslims debate whether Islam is a religion of peace or a religion of violence.
Right. And my comment to that is the Quran and the Hadith are not scriptures of peace. They're scriptures of war. I would say a majority of Muslims are peace-loving. Jan, what time is it?
10:35.
All right, so I got... Okay. I would say the majority of Muslims are peace-loving, and majority of Muslims attend a mosque, and they hear sermons, which are interpretations, which tend towards peace. Okay, but the scripture itself does not go in that direction. All right? But anyway, this is not a class about Islam. So I'm going to leave this thing. I'll take another question, but I'm going to leave this thing. Because, again, the point is this. Those who say the Bible is... not inspired, all right, should compare it to other scriptures that people have said are inspired. Yes?
In the abrogation topic, is anyone able to abrogate the Quran? Any high priest, or do they have a pope in Islam or equivalent?
No, they don't have anything like that. It's up to imams. But Muslim scholars talk about abrogation. This is part of their vocabulary. In fact, even the word abrogate is even in the Quran, where you can tell that Muhammad is saying, people are saying, you're abrogating, you're saying you're wrong, you're changing. He's saying, no, I'm not changing it, I'm improving it. He is actually seems to be responding to critics of what is now called the Quran in his lifetime, defending abrogation. Okay, got it? Well, it depends on what you mean by that. Is abrogation a matter of interpretation or is abrogation a matter of fact? All right, if it's a matter of interpretation, then interpreters could say that this thing replaces that thing, and that could be new, as in nobody said that before. But the text of the Quran is fixed. That's one thing that's clear. The text of Uthman is the Arabic Quran. And so anybody who's claiming abrogation would have to use that text. All right, and these discussions go on amongst Muslims, and it's really their job, not us, to say what's abrogated or not, to be honest with you. They should decide that. Okay, now, again, the point of the Muslim apologist is the New Testament is corrupt. And my response to that is, okay, what's the evidence for this corruption? They'll have, this one verse in Luke, one verse that's, like we had last week, is it children or is it, what was the other one? Is it their children or their deeds or something like that? Actions, right. But that doesn't work because they have to claim that the death of Jesus is a corruption. Because the Quran clearly, without any possible idea of interpretation, says that Jesus was not crucified and that he is not God and that he never claimed to be God. Right. And so if the New Testament has been corrupted to the point where you could argue that possibly both the Quran and the New Testament are inspired, like it even says in the Quran, then the level of corruption would have to rise to the point where even the death of Jesus is a corruption. All right. That's... I don't... How could they do that with a straight face? I mean, how can anybody... Look you in the eye. But I've had Muslim apologists write to my website and, say that Jesus didn't die. How do you know Matthew really wrote Matthew? And they don't realize how silly that really looks. That argument only works in a circle of people, all of whom are Muslims who are just doing circular reasoning. So anyway, moving along, I'm going to skip the whole Baha'i inspiration thing. Hinduism. You have all these, the Vedas, the Upanishads, the epics, Ramayana, Mahabharata, Bhagavad Gita. These are fables about these people who are supposedly emanations of Shiva or Vishnu who came down. The amount disagreement, the amount of contradiction. Thank you. Too much coffee. The amount of contradiction between the Vedas and the Brahmanas and the Puranas and the Bhagavad Gita and the Rig Veda, the amount of contradictions here would boggle the mind. I mean, the idea that these are inspired scriptures doesn't even make sense. In fact, I would say it'd be fair to say that if it were not for Westerners bringing Christianity to India or people from India coming here and interacting with Christians, they wouldn't even try to claim it's inspired. They would just say, this is what we believe or this is what we follow. This is our idea. Because you have to realize that there are actually many religions in India. They're all kind of sort of similar to each other. And, the pagan idols in this part of India are different from the pagan idols over here, are different from the pagan idols over here. And so it's really a group of religions rather than a religion. And it's a group of writings that I don't think anybody would have even tried to defend them as being all in concordance with one another if it were not for the Bible. So discussions about these things being inspired by comparison to the Bible only even happen because people believe the Bible is inspired, and there's good reasons to think the Bible is inspired. All right, so that's what I have to say about that. As far as the reliability of the text, the Vedas, the oldest writings of Hinduism that go back to 1500 to 2000 BC, roughly the time of the earliest part of the Old Testament, they weren't written down for over 1,000 years after they were written. They were oral for over 1,000, not even written at all. Oral only for over 1,000 years. And the oldest manuscript we have comes from 1,800 years after that. So these things, these Vedas, did not exist even in a written form for well over 1,000 years. I think possibly some change could have happened, you know, probably, you know. And then the oldest manuscripts we have are, what, 1,200 years, I'm sorry, 1,800 years after. So is the oldest manuscripts of these Vedas an accurate reflection of the poems that were said 2,500 years before that? No, but does it matter? Does it matter? It doesn't matter. Because, you know, either you believe it or you don't. I mean, it's because it's a philosophy. And I don't think those who were reciting the Rig Veda were saying it's inspired. They're just saying this is an awesome poem. There's certain fulfilled prophecy, okay? Historical accuracy, what are you talking about? I remember one time I had this debate with a Hindu guy. It was an email debate. And he's saying, you know, you say that Krishna is a myth. How dare you say that? He's as real as Jesus Christ. I wrote back, and I was very respectful. You can go on my website. You can read it. It's right there. What I said is right on my website. I was very respectful, very patient. And I simply pointed out that we don't know where Krishna was born. We don't know when he lived. We don't know how he died. He's a myth. There's no historical evidence that supports a person named Krishna who did the things that are found in the Bhagavad Gita is even an actual person. I said that. And he wrote back and he said, that's not true. So I wrote him back and said, so where was he born and when was he born? And he wrote back and he said, well, somewhere in eastern India, all right, somewhere between 1,500 B and 300 B, somewhere between 1,500 BC and 300 BC. So, you know, the idea that the scriptures of Hinduism or Buddhism are somehow inspired, that doesn't really even mean anything. Now, you could argue that their description of theology, of what's true and right, are true. You could go for that. But to say that their scriptures are inspired, it really doesn't really make any sense. All right? So there's the, of course, what is the canon of the Buddhist scriptures? There's one canon. There's a lot of writings there. All right. So, oldest Buddhist text, 100 AD. All right. So, now that finishes our third class. We have two topics to go, really. We're going to spend next week talking about the meaning of biblical inspiration and inerrancy. All right. It's going to raise a lot of questions, some of which maybe you never thought of. And then the last week, I'm going to defend the Bible against the claim that it's full of contradictions and errors. All right? Great. So what time is it? How did I do? Thank you to my wife. Uh-oh. Well, I should have stopped exactly when she said.
The class is not inspired, so.
There you go.